The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Well, hello there. This is Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now it's time to return to the June 2022 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. The theme this month has been the annual coastal issue, Boat Towns. And we're going to start out this last reading of the month, as we always do, with the Decades article. 1980s is what we're up to, the decade of local heroes. These are all written by Philip Gerard. They have been done one decade a year for the past 4 years or so. The Birdman is the title of this month's issue. In Wilmington, a biology professor makes it his mission to understand and protect the water birds that nest along the North Carolina coast and inspires his students to do the same. It's all about the water birds. James F. Parnell, a young PhD from North Carolina State University, never forgets this. In 1964, he accepted a position in the four-faculty department of biological science at Wilmington College, now the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. His master's thesis had taken him to Pea Island National Wildlife Refuge, and after he came to the coast for good, he devoted his career to studying, understanding, and protecting water birds. By the 1980s, he has become the most effective champion of the many species that inhabit the coast. The royal tern, a crow-sized bird with a distinctive orange-red bill that favors bare nesting sites, where it deposits a single buff-colored egg in a sand scrape, marking its presence with a high-pitched ki-rear or ki-kareet call. Its smaller, yellow-billed cousin, the least tern, also a beach nester, which emits a sharp killick or kip, 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 kip. The 2-foot-long white ibis, which probes tidal flats for crayfish and crabs, then flies away with a startling irk, irk, irk. The magisterial blue heron, with a wingspan of almost 5 or 6 feet, rather, which lives on fish, frogs, and small critters, and when disturbed, flies off with a hoarse, trumpeting squawk. The brown pelican, up to a 4.5 feet long, with a wingspan of 6.5 feet. The only non-white pelican in the world, this marine bird obtains its food by diving from the air, its wings half-folded as it plunges into the surf, the Audubon field guide says. During one of those dives, the pouched bill takes in both fish and water. The bird drains out the water before throwing its head back and swallowing the fish. North Carolina's waterways, flyways, and coastal habitat often teem with black skimmers, great and snowy egrets, and cormorants, along with a variety of gulls, other terns, egrets, and herons. In the late 1970s, Parnell conducted the first survey of all of the colonial water bird breeding sites along the coast, initially in a Cessna piloted by his student, Frank Henry, and then on the ground. He flew us up the coast, and we located all the islands and came back and put the field crew together and then revisited all of them, Parnell recalls. We surveyed the whole coast in one summer season. I was having a ball. I loved it. Walker Golden, or rather Golder, a self-described water rat, grew up reading Audubon nature books in a house in Wrightsville Beach. And when he wasn't reading, he was sailing, fishing, or surfing. I spend every waking hour in the water or on the water, around the water, enjoying every bit of it, he recalls. At New Hanover High School, he joined an outdoor club started by his teacher, one of Parnell's former students, that canoed local rivers and hiked sections of the Appalachian Trail. In the early 80s, as a sophomore biology major at UNC Wilmington, he's invited to join Parnell's summer survey crew. That was just a fabulous summer, Golder says. We traveled the entire North Carolina coast, got to see most of it by small boat, going to every island on the coast and counting every nest of every water bird species. After that, he says, I just took about any course Parnell offered. For Golder, the young, congenial professor becomes a mentor and a role model, and the two begin a lifelong professional collaboration. He treated every student so kindly and politely, Golder recalls. He enabled them to learn from him by participating in the work that he was doing. Parnell's easygoing manner only increases the respect that he garners from his students. He was up on a pedestal, Golder says. Meanwhile, maintenance dredging of the Intracoastal Waterway and other channels by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has built up selected sandbars into spoil islands formed by repeated dumping of the sand. Officials at the Corps learn that birds are now nesting on some of them. They approach Parnell to investigate the situation. He recounts their queries. Which island should the Corps deposit on and when? Which island shouldn't they deposit on at a given time? That was what the Corps was interested in knowing, especially when they were doing their planning. We didn't want them to dump sand on an island that had birds on it. Parnell recognized that dredge material islands can mimic natural habitat conditions. What Dr. Parnell also realized at the time, Golder says, was that there was very little research on the importance of these islands to birds. And nobody was looking after these islands. None of these islands were protected by anybody. Several of Parnell's biology students hold full-time positions with the Corps, and they bring their ecological ethic to their work. They were champions for water birds. They were really terrific folks who wanted to do the right thing wherever they could, Golder says. The Corps moves a lot of sediment around more than anybody else. They can do good things with it, or they can do bad things with it. Dr. Parnell wanted to push them in the right direction, to do good things with that sand, to restore or create habitat for nesting water birds. Some birds, such as royal terns, require bare sites for nesting. Others, such as egrets and herons, need foliage over. So it's crucial to orchestrate the timing of which islands are replenished with new strata of bare sand and which are allowed to harbor vegetation. Once Parnell's crew has extensive data, he can recommend a course of action. But it then becomes the job of the Corps, other agencies, or nonprofits to act. We were fact-finding. We were not managing, he says. That's where Audubon came in. Parnell enlists the aid of a faculty colleague, Donald A. McCrimmon, to invite Audubon into the process, which also includes the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission, the Corps, Sea Grant, a major early funder, and other parties. Dr. Parnell led the effort, Golder recalls. He pulled together the right partners at the right time. Parnell's amiable nature and his ability to present data in a clear and concise manner, comprehensible to both scientists and policymakers, combined to create effective and durable collaborations. In many ways, the Corps was crucial to the success of the program. We didn't try to run over them. We tried to work with them, Parnell says. They couldn't always do exactly what you wanted, but when they could help, they did. They actually funded us at times. Because dredging is undertaken during the winter, non-breeding months, Parnell makes sure to ferry his partners in the Corps to the nesting grounds in the summer so they can see firsthand the positive effects of their decisions. In 1982, Audubon leases from the state Battery Island in the lower Cape Fear River. From Parnell's early work there, funded by Audubon, derives the germ of a coastal sanctuary system. Audubon has a history of creating waterbird sanctuaries, including multiple island sites in Texas, Florida, and Maine. So you had a model in place. You had a need in North Carolina, Golder explains. He brought the partners together. Then Audubon said, let's establish a sanctuary system in North Carolina like the other ones that we have. In 1989, Audubon formally inaugurates the Coastal Island Sanctuary Program to protect and restore nesting habitat for water birds. From a modest start, just two islands in the Cape Fear Estuary, Battery and Striking Islands, the system eventually encompasses more than 30 sites from Dare to Brunswick counties, 21 managed by Audubon and the others managed directly by the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission. It's hard to measure the exact impact of the sanctuaries. The natural environment is complex and dynamic, but there are significant clues. When we first started, there was one colony of brown pelicans with 100 or so pairs, maybe, Barnell says. In 2020, I think there was something like 5,000 pairs of brown pelicans nesting in North Carolina. Golder, who eventually becomes Deputy Director of North Carolina Audubon and subsequently Executive Director of the North Carolina Coastal Land Trust, says Parnell's work spread throughout all the other states on the Atlantic coast. Parnell achieves a reputation among the International Waterbird Society, not just as an expert on coastal waterbird, but as a leader in waterbird conservation who can organize real-world solutions to environmental threats to birds by getting the right people around a table to form a plan of action. Parnell downplays his own role in the effort to establish the waterbird sanctuary system. I just happened to be here at the right time and got in as it started, he says. I've been real pleased that it has worked out the way it has. But Golder is emphatic. Rest assured, he deserves the credit, and his colleagues would say the same. Indeed, in 1995, the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission confers on Parnell a significant honor, naming the entire archipelago of sanctuary sites the Dr. James F. Parnell Water Bird Sanctuary System. David Allen, supervisor for the eastern region of the Commission's Wildlife Diversity Program, explains the rationale. Dr. Parnell did most of the early work on colonial waterbirds in North Carolina. He worked a lot with the Corps of Engineers, worked a lot with us, the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission, and he wrote the first management plan for waterbird management in North Carolina. Parnell says simply, I thoroughly enjoyed it all and felt like we were doing some good. Coming next month, the tragedy of the Space Shuttle Challenger shapes a generation. Certainly something I remember viewing on television. And now, how a family found its moorings. In the village of Oriental, on the Neuse River, the new owners of a boatyard faced their first big challenge, Hurricane Florence, written by Katie Kane. The storm was headed straight for Oriental, and my mom was scared. She was talking to me by phone from her office at Sailcraft Service, the boatyard and marina that she owns with my stepfather, Mike. The skies were clear that day, giving a false sense of security to the boating towns that dot the North Carolina coast. Still, my parents were preparing for the worst. The tropical storm that had developed southeast of Bermuda later, earlier that September had now reached hurricane status. Mom looked out the window to see Mike driving their 35-ton travel lift, a vehicle with a crane that's used to raise vessels out of the water, from its usual spot in the boatyard and out onto Lupton Drive. The lift inched its way down the street to the Baptist Church, where the higher ground made it less likely a vehicle would be subjected to flood damage. It had seen more action than normal that week. The Sailcraft team had used the lift to haul about 40 boats out of the water, filling up the yard as much as they could. I was sitting in a pub nearly 4,000 miles away in London, where I was spending a college semester studying abroad. One of the TVs above the bar showed video clips of boarded-up businesses and empty Harris Teeter shelves. I didn't catch where the correspondent was reporting from, but I knew that my family was somewhere nearby, bracing for a hurricane that would pull at the roots that they'd just put down in North Carolina. Only 5 months earlier, they'd packed up their lives in New Jersey and taken a chance on a marina in this little boating town that none of us had ever heard of. They had no friends there. They'd never lived in south of Monmouth County. They'd never heard of a Piggly Wiggly. All they knew was that they needed a change. They wanted to build something together that they could be proud of. Maybe Hurricane Florence was just some cruel introduction to life on the Carolina coast. I wanted to ask my mom how she was feeling, but I could hear it in her voice. She was nervous, fearful for her business, for her home, for employees who had quickly become extended family, welcoming her and Mike into this small boating community. A few days later, on September 14th, I sat in class with my phone hidden underneath my desk, my eyes glued to the satellite map, showing swirls of green, blue, and orange spinning over my adopted home. I took in the numbers. About 455,000 people evacuated. Landfall at 7:15 a.m. near Wrightsville Beach. Maximum sustainable winds of 90 miles per hour. 30 inches of rainfall projected. My mom texted me her own numbers. 5 feet of water in the boatyard, about $100,000 worth of damage. My heart broke for them. My stepfather is a proud waterman. His father owned a marina on the Navesink River in New Jersey, where Mike spent most of his time as a child. His mom was a nurse who often worked late nights, so after school, Mike went to hang out by the boats. As he got older, he took more of an interest in running the marina and began learning everything he could about boat mechanics. Mike has been driving travel lifts since he was about 12 years old, Mom says with a laugh. He began working at the marina in high school and soon became the head mechanic. Mike and my mom met on a boat. She'd purchased a 21-foot hurricane deck boat, but she didn't know the waterways and wasn't comfortable taking it out on her own. So she took it to the experts, the marina down on the street from my childhood home in Rumson. It was a town staple where everyone rented skiffs to go fishing on calm summer mornings. I often rode there on my bike to pick up bait for afternoon fishing at the local dock. My mom asked the marina owner if he could give her driving lessons. No, but my son can, he said. Mike met Mom out on the dock where her boat was waiting. I could tell she was nervous, he remembers. He took her out on the river and taught her how to navigate through the channels, read, write, return. He showed her where the sandbars would pop up at low tide, and eventually she became calmer and more confident behind the wheel. As they returned to the marina, Mom, with a little trepidation, pulled the hull forward, carefully aligning the boat between the pilings. She hit reverse and backed in perfectly, just as if she'd done it 100 times. She smiled at Mike. He smiled back. How good was that? She said proudly. That was great, he said. But you know, this isn't your slip, right? He laughed as he pointed out the neighboring spot. Immediately after he docked the boat in the correct slip, Mike asked my mom out on a date. Ask anyone crazy enough to buy a boatyard, and they'll tell you that you aren't just buying a building with some tools. You're inheriting a community, a significant part of the town's history. This is especially true in Oriental, the sailing capital of North Carolina, a town of about 900 residents and 3,000 boats. It can take newcomers a while to get their bearings and find their place in this tight-knit community. Mike and Mom had no idea when they purchased Sailcraft that it came with an unofficial member of the Oriental royalty. The yard manager, George Midget, or his Georgeness, as my mother and the sign that marks his parking spot call him, is related to the family that purchased the farmland that eventually became Oriental. His people are responsible for preserving the town's fishing culture, and George has happily carried on the role of family historian. Oriental was incorporated in 1899 after George's ancestors began developing and selling the land they bought. The story goes that a midget named Rebecca, George's great aunt many times over, suggested calling the town Oriental after discovering a nameplate of a steamship that wrecked somewhere off the shores of the Outer Banks. George, like my stepfather, grew up around boats, which is inevitable for a child raised in Oriental. He repaired the first one at around age 8 or 10, when he and his cousin Turtle came across a beat-up Louisiana pirogue. We found it washed up in one of those little mosquito ditches up here in Whitaker Creek and got Daddy to come help us tow it out of there, George remembers. He and Turtle devoted their afternoons to repairing the boat, packing it full of cotton wad to make it float. We bailed and paddled. One of us would be bailing, the other would be paddling, he says with a laugh. We had a good time that summer. When his mom bought a boat and 100 crab pots, George started his own crabbing venture. I put myself through college fishing with crab pots, he says. After serving as his dad's first mate, George's official boating career began at a local fish house where the shrimp and the crab boats came in and unloaded their fresh catch. The fish house would sell to buyers from places as far away as Annapolis and Baltimore, Maryland. All of that was back in the boating community in Oriental, was just beginning to branch out from its commercial fishing roots. George remembers the first man to own a sailboat in town, a retired German sea captain who'd settled here. He was one of the last men to sail a square rigger around either of the Capes, Good Hope or Cape Horn, George says. Soon after, around 1965, a small group from Raleigh began coming down here every July to race one- or two-man sailboats, an event they called the Oriental Sailing Social. It got pretty big, he says. There'd be so many people here in those little boats back in those days. It was just amazing. I'd never seen anything like it before in my life, coming from a small town. Now George spends upwards of 8 hours on the water in his canoe, winding through the creeks in which he grew up fishing and crabbing, most of which he sees these days, of what he sees these days, are sailboats, many of which he helped get ready for open waters. As the yard manager at Sailcraft, George trains employees and oversees ongoing projects. But he's much more than just the yard manager. George helped my stepdad build the boatyard of his dreams. He taught my mom about the history and biodiversity of the creeks near Sailcraft. George has shared with my family the lore and legends of our new home. A little more than a year after Hurricane Florence blew through town, the Sailcraft team is gathered around my grandmother's table for a big Thanksgiving dinner. When the storm blew over and the sun came out again, the boatyard crew spent about 6 weeks cleaning debris, launching boats, power washing structures in the yard to kill bacteria, and bringing in damaged boats from yards that didn't survive the hurricane. Soon, life at Sailcraft was calm again. I reach for the stuffing and pass it to Eric, the boatyard's 6'8" service manager, whose distinct voice I hear in the background every time I call my mom on the phone. He's sitting next to my grandma, making her 5'2" frame seem even smaller than usual. This isn't the first time that the team has come to my grandma's house, which sits just feet away from the yard. Some of them come by after work to see if she needs anything fixed around the house. Some of them come around for snacks. My grandma always has really good stuff. We don't have a watchdog, my mom likes to say. We have a watch grandma. Many of the employees at Sailcraft live far from their families, so my mom has invited them to have dinner with us this year. She can't bear the thought of people she cares about being alone on Thanksgiving. Having recently moved here from San Francisco, Sailcraft's rigger, Ray, brought along homemade sourdough bread. Eric and his wife, Heather, arrived with their famous corn casserole, which is more dairy than corn, the secret to its popularity. George and his wife, Gail, have hauled in fresh moonshine, a bottle that looks older than I am, with hints of barnacles around the bottom. I call it Barnacle Bill, George says as he passes it around. I'm sitting across from my grandma and my mom, and when I look up at them, my heart melts. We've always had small Thanksgiving dinners, but sharing this day with this big group of people, people who were strangers just more than a year ago, in my grandma's home, where water as high as the table were gathered around, had flooded her garage. I couldn't be more grateful to call them family. Well, we don't have very much time left, but let's see how much of this article we can get to. It's broken up into small pieces, which is good. Sunset sail from the deck of a boat. A sunset over the water is even more spectacular. With gentle waves as the stage, charismatic captains as the cast, and an orange glow in the backdrop, these evening cruises put on a show that's sure to impress. Written by Rebecca Woltz. Down East Rover in Manteo. Wind whips the sails of the 55-foot topsail schooner Down East Rover, propelling it forward as dolphins play in its wake. Captain Kim Winslow steers the boat through Roanoke Sound, pointing out the top of the Wright Brothers National Memorial in Kill Devil Hills while taking advantage of the same conditions that benefited Orville and Wilbur's flight experiments. The Outer Banks is perfect for one very good reason, the wind, says Winslow, who owns the boat with his wife Kennedy, or Kimberly, excuse me. There's almost always a good wind, which means we can really sail. They're at downeastrover.com. Edenton Bay Cruises in Edenton. Gliding along the Edenton waterfront, Captain Mark Thessier points out the 1767 Chauhan County Courthouse, the oldest in North Carolina, the 1886 Roanoke River Lighthouse, the only remaining screw pile lighthouse in the state, and John's Island, a privately owned nature preserve. The quiet electric motor of the Liberty, that's T-E-A at the end, owned by Thessier and his wife, Teresa, allow him to keep a conversational volume while sharing historical facts and stories with his passengers. Other than his occasional narration, he says, the only thing you'll hear as we're cruising along is the ripple of the water. And maybe the occasional honk from his conch shell, which the Coast Guard has approved as one of the boat's official horns. Lookout Cruises in Beaufort. The Lookout catamaran motors about an eighth of a mile out from the Beaufort waterfront to a spot behind the dunes, where the first mate asks for volunteers to pull up the sails. It takes two, three, and sometimes four people to raise the 150-pound mainsail and the jib, or front sail, while the other passengers cheer them on. From there, it's off to wherever the wind takes them. We don't have a destination, says Captain Steve Bishop. Depending on the conditions of the wind and water, the Lookout might sail behind the Maritime Forest and dunes of the Shackelford Banks, offering them a glimpse of wild horses, or in calmer weather, out to the ocean. There, Bishop points out, Fort Macon, constructed after the war in 1812 and established as a state park in 1924, and the site of the wreck of what is believed to be the Queen Anne's Revenge, Blackbeard's flagship. That's lookoutcruises.com. And then there's the Lady Swan in Swansboro. Captain Tim Simpson expertly navigates the Lady Swan through the marshy waters of West Channel, startling a great blue heron out of its hiding place among the tall grass. Neon green in the summer sun, the blades sway back and forth, dancing in the warm breeze. During low tide, the grass teems with life as the shallow water reveals oysters clinging to reefs at the base of the vegetation and fiddler crabs scurrying between the stalks. Simpson steers his pontoon boat past Huggins Island toward Bear Island, both part of Hammocks Beach State Park. Thanks to the presence of the park, which limits development, this area is full of unspoiled beauty, and Simpson and his wife and first mate Jane stress the importance of being good stewards of the environment. On one cruise, the couple even rescued an endangered Kemp's Ridley, disentangled the sea turtle from a fishing line, and released it back into the ocean. LadySwanTours.com. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine, and I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments, questions? Call the studios, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.